Ones We've Been Waiting For.
You were just listening to David Corton, Our Planetary Existential Crisis. David Corton is a philosopher and visionary, and a leading voice for climate and social justice. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To order copies of today's program, David Corton, Our Planetary Existential Crisis, and for Noam Chomsky's book, Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emportés par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse, une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulever nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, a major storm shuts down the electricity grid in Puerto Rico. Vulture capitalists and a corporate junta there are largely to blame for these repeated failures of the grid. we'll feature a special report from the storm-torn U.S. colony. Also, are two border governors systematically violating the rights of those fleeing violence and extreme poverty from applying for asylum? And border activists preparing for a major pilgrimage for human rights? And is Haiti a lethal place to live? All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network from the San Francisco Bay Area. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along. Well, you may have heard Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico's southwest coast on Sunday as it unleashed landslides, knocked the power grid out, and ripped up asphalt from roads and flung the pieces around. Hundreds of people were evacuated or rescued across the island as floodwaters rose swiftly. Rushing rivers of brown water enveloped cars, first floors, and even an airport runway in the island's southern region. Why does this power grid keep breaking down? What is going on there? Some blame it on what they call a junta, that the U.S. colony has been sold out to a Canadian corporation, and they don't seem to give a damn about what happens to the people of Puerto Rico. Joining us to talk about this is somebody who we've depended upon in the past to give us information, attorney activist Judith Birkin. She refers to it as the junta run by the LUMA, I guess it's the LUMA consortium, run out of Canada, no good for the people of Puerto Rico. Judith, welcome back to Flashpoints. First of all, how bad is the situation this round? This is becoming a very old story for you all down there.
Yes, thanks. Thanks a lot, Dennis. Thanks for having me, and thanks to your listeners for their interest in Puerto Rico. First of all, I have to make a clarification. There are two things that you've kind of meshed together. One is the junta and one is LUMA. Junta is the governing dictatorial board imposed by the United States in 2016 to basically run everything here and to supposedly negotiate Puerto Rico's debt and the power authority's debt. LUMA is the consortium primarily based in Canada, which came in about a year and a half ago to run the power grid, supposedly through a private public partnership, but it's a total giveaway. And that's what's been involved in the most recent series of blackouts, which were before the storm. We've had terrible blackouts in Puerto Rico, but now I'll get on to the storm. The storm, as you basically pointed out, you know, has hit agriculture, horses, bridges have fallen, people's homes have been rushed away with the storm surge. Barrios, full barrios are without any access to completely incommunicado. There have been landslides all over the country. And, you know, tomorrow is our five-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria, which followed Hurricane Irma in 2017. And this was a different kind of storm event, but not one that couldn't have been anticipated. It was a rain event, primarily. That's why you're not hearing about the roofs being blown off and that kind of thing. What you're hearing about are the mudslides, are the rivers, almost every river and creek and estuary in Puerto Rico is outside of its embankments, and it's been a devastating situation. It did not just hit yesterday. It was hitting for several days before with, you know, prelude to the storm, and right now we're still under an extreme rain situation, and it looks like the National Weather Service was way off this time and told us we'd be getting like 6 to 10 inches, which is a bad storm. But in most of Puerto Rico, and not just the southwest, most of Puerto Rico, there have been rainfalls in the 20, 22, 28, and probably by the end, 36, 38 inches of rain in maybe 3 or 4 days. It's still here. It was lightning just a few moments ago where I live, which is in San Juan, which was one of the few places that was not as severely hit. Now, if I can, I'll go into a little bit about what's been going on with our power authority, which was organized. It's an authority that the facilities have been allowed to deteriorate, which is a pretty typical situation when
And this is what you refer to as the junta, right? I'm sorry to interrupt you, is what you refer to as the junta.
No, the junta is the board that runs Puerto Rico.
That appointed the power authority.
All right. Okay. The power authority was contracted by the Puerto Rican government, but those who are giving extreme credit to their neoliberal visions of privatization and that kind of thing. And this has been a struggle for a long time, because the workers' union at the power authority, which had something like 8,000 workers, was one of the strongest in the country. This was a way to break the union. This consortium was given a contract for the private operation of transmission, not the entire operation, but transmission and distribution and client service, customer service, for the power authority. And the workers were essentially pushed out. And at this point, when this happened a year and a half ago, at that point, our power grid was in very poor shape, as people have stated for many years, as was evident during the 2017 hurricane. And there was a lot of federal money coming in to pay for repairs, to pay for new projects, supposedly. And so instead of having that for the benefit of the people of Puerto Rico, this consortium was hired, basically, without having to put up a single penny, was hired to run these critical aspects, not generation, but transmission, distribution, and customer service. And since they took over on June 1st, 2021, we have had seven rate increases at a time when our pensions are being cut by the junta. Not the Luma, by the junta. You have to get these terms clear. And where people are really suffering because of this. In the meantime, the workers, the skilled workers, most of whom belong to the union, were given the following choice. You can either go over to Luma, which is this privatizer, consortium, and lose all your acquired benefits, pension and salary guarantee and job guarantee, or you can go get another position in the government. So they overwhelmingly, the workers decided not to go over to Luma. And what happened was we lost all those skills, the biggest asset that the power authority had for dealing with a situation like this. And we are also now paying these highly skilled workers to do essentially make work in the government of Puerto Rico. So we're left with a power grid which now has, Luma absolutely refuses all our document requests and the legislature's document requests and everything to give us precise information. We don't know how many lines people Luma has, but we know that they're very, very reduced from the thousands that were there before the transition. We don't know. We do know what their executives are getting paid, and they're in the millions of dollars. We also know that the lines people who are being brought in right as we speak from outside of Puerto Rico to deal with lines, transmission lines, in a tropical country that is very mountainous and has poor infrastructure largely, these people that are coming in here are going to be paid extraordinary amounts, going to be put up at luxurious hotels, and they won't know what they're doing because the skills that have been developed from the Puerto Rican lines people, which were developed over 20, 30 years of service, those people are being put to waste just to substitute by these people from outside. So we don't know. I mean, the power grid was shut off intentionally, fully. The prelude to this is we've been having blackouts since Luma took over, and a lot of blackouts. I mean, it's a daily incident in Puerto Rico. But the other prelude to this is we had very poor weather conditions prior to this, so we have a lot of saturated ground. But once the storm hit, about 100,000 people didn't have electrical power right at the beginning of that, just from the blackouts or the very beginnings of the storm. And then about halfway through the day yesterday, they shut off, Luma shut off the entire island. The information I've been able to get before talking to you is that right now there are 1,629,000 separate households without light, without power. We call it light, without power in Puerto Rico as we speak. Supposedly, Luma says they'll come back, the electricity will come back in a short period of time. But since this was the other aspect is that because of the shutdown of the electrical power facility, you end up with people without water as well. And we now have 870,000 individual households without water.
Can I ask you to adjust your body a little bit? We just started to lose you a little bit, so maybe if you adjust yourself.
How's that? I'll talk to the phone better. Any better?
Okay. Yes. Thank you. So 1,629,000 people are now facing problems because of the grid. They're without power.
Those are households. I figure 2 to 3, 4, 5, 6 people per each of those households. I mean, we only have, after the migrations of the last years, we only have about 3.3 million people in Puerto Rico. So that's the overwhelming majority of the people in Puerto Rico. And then you get, you know, because of that, you end up with a situation right now as I sit and I talk to you. I live in a condominium which has a generator, so I haven't felt the direct effects of the light being shut off. But those people who live in the countryside or in the poorer sectors of San Juan who do not have access to generators are just suffering terribly as we speak. And we're going to start seeing the same thing we saw in Maria, which we're just beginning to see right now, which are the people who can't get access to medical services, but who can't use their oxygen, people who cannot refrigerate their insulin. Those kinds of things go on at a time like that. As of now, as far as we can tell, there have only been 3 deaths reported. So it's a much less lethal storm than the one 5 years ago. One of those was a man was dealing with a generator, so it's directly related to the power situation. And another one was a man in Lebra who had a major health issue, and he couldn't get flown off the island of Culebra into the main island of Puerto Rico.
Well, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with Judith Birkin. She is an attorney, a human rights activist. She's been on the island for decades and decades, and she has done some spectacular information gathering for us over the years. The situation that the people of Puerto Rico face, you know, I mean, this is old. And it really is, you know, there's all kinds of talk about, is the British Empire going to sustain itself?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is part of that policy. This is left over. And this is what happens to colonies under the United States of America. And it really is one of the untold stories of our time. I mean, some people know about it, but this isn't, you know, the only time this is ever a story is when there's a hurricane. People weren't paying that much attention when the United States was using Puerto Rico as a target for new weaponry and Vieques and poisoning the people that way. So why would they even give a damn about getting them energy or making sure the kids can go to school or people who are on diabetes can get dialysis? It really, this is an old story, isn't it? It's a story of occupation and domination.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's remarkable to me, even people who I consider, you know, highly educated on political issues don't realize that we have in Puerto Rico is a colonial situation. It's out there. The word is burdo, it's open, it's nothing hidden about it. Since 2016, as I mentioned, and as you mentioned, we wrote by UDA, which is appointed by the United States. Nothing that's done in Puerto Rico is for the benefit of the Puerto Rican people. What's happening, nothing, I mean, that's a little extreme, but the policies that govern in the colony are those that are convenient to the United States. And so that's a classic situation. You look at, you know, think Britain in India or, you know, Belgian Congo or whatever, you know, in terms of racism and the colonial situation. And this becomes a testing ground for policies on all the privatization policies. So I don't mean to say that this is an issue in the States, I know it is. On all the privatization policies, you'll see that the most extreme manifestations of those are here in Puerto Rico. This goes along with, as you were talking about schools a second ago, the policies of the last few years have resulted in closures of 600 schools on the island. And this has also led to migration. There's a tax policy in effect which gives certain tax benefits, major tax benefits to millionaires and billionaires who arrive in Puerto Rico from the United States and pay zero tax on their capital gains, only 4% taxes on their earned income. Which, highly disadvantaged those of us who actually live and work in Puerto Rico. And okay. We've had this whole new influx of, like, crypto billionaires and people like that arriving in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a lot going on here emblematic of the worst that go on in the States.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, Judith, but the line is just getting... I think it's the same infrastructure that's killing us on this line that's putting everybody in Puerto Rico in danger.
And so let me see if I can say it. It's more stato. But when we have major rain and hurricane events in Puerto Rico, we have very unreliable communications and internet.
Yes. Yes, we get it. We get it. I wish I could send you an umbrella with a phone line. I really am sorry that we do this story again and again. And it really, as I said earlier, it's about the nature of domination. And there's a lot that has to be thought about in terms of Puerto Rico. We're going to leave it there for now, but Judith, I hope we can come back and find a better line really soon.
With a better connection. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. We've been speaking with Judith Burke, and she's an activist attorney based in Puerto Rico, and always with good information. Very sorry about that difficult line, but obviously the infrastructure is always impacted there by storms and rain, and they're having a hell of a time right now. So We'll continue our coverage of that occupied country called Puerto Rico. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined again by Camila Perez Bustillo, and we're going to be talking about, well, among other things, about immigration and about what these two governors seem to have in mind for people fleeing war and destruction in their homelands. It certainly isn't to give them a chance to apply for asylum. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And the, I don't know what to call it, the immigration policy breakdown that causes so much suffering to people who are already suffering, fleeing war, fleeing violence in their homeland. And the United States continues to create a policy that makes it worse. We're hearing from lawyers for civil rights are seeking a criminal investigation of migrants who were flown to Martha's Vineyard as part of an anti-liberal political stunt by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. They're given brochures falsely promising cash assistance, job placement services, a very diabolical, very troubling, vicious way to run a campaign, because these are campaign stunts. Wouldn't you say, Camila Perez Bustillo, these are racist, nothing more or less than racist campaign stunts that go right along with U.S. policy over so many years?
Thanks, Dennis, for inviting me. And, you know, I think one thing we have to, you know, look at more critically is the way the media describes what's going on and uses the word stunts. These are not stunts. These are people's lives that are being played with. And what's going on is susceptible to investigation as a crime, both domestically and internationally. Domestically, because apparently what we have is the unauthorized use of federal COVID relief money that was given to states like Florida and Texas, you know, Abbott and DeSantis, respectively, who are the protagonists in this. Really, what we have to look at is sort of a humanitarian atrocity. And the other thing is people being put on these buses, or in the case of Martha's Vineyard, a plane, under false pretenses, as you said, which, you know, in legal terms is an act of fraud, of inducement. And the other thing is, what we have is, you know, there's a concept legally called false imprisonment, which is basically, you know, the bottom line is it's only the state, you know, states, federal, civil authorities that have the right to detain someone. Essentially, this is, you know, a government agent, governors of Florida and Texas, respectively, in effect, detaining people, falsely claiming that they're being taken to, you know, promised jobs or shelters or whatever, none of that being, you know, grounded in reality, and they're detaining them meanwhile. And the only body that's entitled to do that legally is the Border Patrol. In other words, state police can't do that. Local police can't do that. And, of course, that's a huge issue. You know, just like we have the movement against mass incarceration, we have the movement against mass detention and deportation. And a key aspect of that is to shut down the federal immigration detention system. And so the key thing is it's Governor DeSantis and Abbott deputizing themselves. Nobody authorized them, certainly not the federal government in this case. So that's, you know, that's the heart of the problem here. Is this is part of that whole kind of states' rights logic that we're seeing, of course, in the arena of reproductive rights, you know, as Roe v. Wade is rolled back and states, you know, coming in to fill the vacuum. It was, of course, at the heart of the civil rights movement, Mississippi and Alabama basically saying they could do what they pleased with African-American children and communities, including lynching and school segregation. So we're back to that kind of logic. It shouldn't surprise us. It's in Texas and Florida, right? It's a long legacy of this.
Long legacy. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Camilo Perez-Bustillo. He is the executive director for the San Francisco Bay chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, an old friend of this show, really deeply engaged in fighting against this inhumane, violent, and oftentimes deadly immigration system breakdown that has defined United States policy through Democrats and Republicans over dozens of years. And it does seem like it's at an all-time low. I mean, it was sort of triggered through Trump, but it really, Trump's policies were essentially consistent with policies for decades, right? That this is not really new.
I mean, the mistreatment of migrants, of course not. That's a long U.S. tradition, right? And, you know, some people might be watching, you know, this new documentary on the U.S. and the Holocaust. I mean, there's a very tragic story there about how far back this history goes. And, of course, we have Chinese exclusion. And, you know, I mean, U.S. immigration policy has always been inherently and necessarily racist and xenophobic. And, of course, that's a long story. And, you know, the Texas Rangers were the origin of the Border Patrol. And so Governor Abbott's role has, you know, a historical footnote that we should add to it. But the key thing is this. We have to separate this out from the electoral debate that's going on, you know, the midterms around, you know, Biden and a supposedly open border. The border is not open. So one of the things also that we see here is, you know, the fake news, the lies that Abbott and DeSantis are promoting. Abbott and DeSantis are A, saying it's an open border. It's not. Just ask the Haitians 1 year ago who were driven back at Del Rio by the reins used as whips of the Border Patrol up until now with impunity. And that's why there was a major action this morning at the White House, you know, commemorating that anniversary. But the other thing is, ask, of course, the tens of thousands of Haitians who've been sent back on the death flights that we've been documenting, you know, among others, through Witness at the Border and organizations like the Haitian Bridge Alliance and the Haiti Action Center, et cetera. But the key thing is this. This is, you know, using human beings as chips on the table in this great game over migration policy. It's turning migration policy not into a stunt, but into a very dangerous kind of circus where what's forgotten is, for example, the dozens of Venezuelans who were flown to Martha's Vineyard, it was mostly Venezuelans apparently, they're the product of U.S. policy. Whether it was under Trump or whether it was under Biden, that hasn't changed much either. The U.S. war against Venezuela, let's say, just like the U.S. war against Cuba or against the people of Haiti or of Central America. There's a reason why Venezuelans are coming in the tens of thousands, and it's directly traceable to U.S. policy, just like it is with Salvadorans and Guatemalans and Haitians and Mexicans and so on. So the bottom line is this, whether it's Biden or Trump, until that framework, until that power relationship changes between the peoples of Latin America and the Caribbean and the U.S., until that imperial equation shifts, the same one that sinks Puerto Rico into darkness every time a storm like this hits, as we just heard from Judith Birkin, who's been doing this work for decades. It's all part of the same calculus. And until that changes, people will continue to come. There was, you know, major coverage over the weekend about how all of the supposed efforts of the Biden administration, of Kamala Harris particularly, supposedly to address root causes, have failed. How the administration, just like prior administrations, sadly, again, there's continuity there, is not really serious about addressing those root causes, because that would mean changing that equation, changing that calculus underneath everything. The problem is the imperial and neocolonial relationship between the U.S., Latin America, and the Caribbean, and, of course, the rest of the world.
We are speaking with Camilo Perez Bustillo. Again, he is an international human rights lawyer, co-chair of National Lawyers Guild Task Force on the Americas. He is now the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He also works with Witness at the Border. They and other groups are organizing now for another pilgrimage to deal with this. You want to talk a little bit about the origins of the pilgrimage and what people might want to know about what you're up to in terms of the active side of dealing with this life and death human rights issue?
Absolutely. You know, at the core of this initiative is a partnership between Witness at the Border and the Bay Area chapter of the Guild that I have the honor of being the executive director of, based here on Cap Street in the Mission. And what we're asking you all to do throughout the Bay Area, throughout California, which, let's remind ourselves once again, is after all a border state. We often forget that. And the border is everywhere. The border is in every community and workplace where our communities are present. So the border runs through the Bay Area just as it does along the U.S.-Mexico, you know, the river on both sides. So the key thing is this. We're asking you to join us beginning December 2nd at the eastern extreme of the border at Brownsville and Matamoros, where Witness at the Border began with its vigil that you covered so attentively, Dennis, so supportively, against the MPP program, the so-called Remain in Mexico program. We started, you know, right before the pandemic. So now we're picking up that thread. We're going back to the river. We're going back to the border. Join us December 2nd at Brownsville, Matamoros, and join us at any point along the way, you know, at key crossings like Del Rio, and we'll be in Uvalde, which, after all, we've talked about before on your program, Dennis, is a border community as well. And we'll be in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez and the two Nogaleses, you know, in Arizona and in Sonora. And we will be culminating this journey for justice, this pilgrimage for border justice, in San Diego, Tijuana, completing the circle. But we need you to join us here in the Bay Area, in LA, all of those who are listening there, throughout the state and throughout the region and the country. Join us at the website of the National Lawyers Guild San Francisco Bay Area Chapter, nlgsf.org. Join us at www.witnessattheborder.org. Join us on the Facebook group for Witness at the Border. You can sign up for any component or portion of the journey that you can be present, if it's one day, one week, or the full 3 weeks. December 2nd through 18, you will see a full itinerary of about between 15 and 20 stops. It's evolving as I speak between those two points, Brownsville and San Diego. Please join us. And all of this will culminate on International Migrants Day, the day that's been declared by the UN as the day in defense of the human rights of migrants around the world, December 18th. It will also include December 10th, which is International Human Rights Day. We'll be observing that. And also December 12th, which is the day of the Virgen de Guadalupe. And all of this will be in the spirit of the Posada, which is all about the underlying values and principles, the ethics of hospitality and solidarity, which we will be evoking throughout this journey. Join us in the journey for justice. Join us in Oakland on Saturday, October 9th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Preservation Park to celebrate the role and the contribution of the National Lawyers Guild. To all of this, you can see more information at our website. October 9th, Oakland, Preservation Park from 2 to 5, and join us at the border beginning December 2nd.
All right. I just got one more area that we have a couple of minutes left over, and I want to go back. Yesterday was Mexican Independence Day. I think we did the greet. I think it was yesterday. I'm losing track of time. And it's nice to imagine an independent Mexico, but it's really been the leadership that so many people had so much hope on in terms of the new leadership of Mexico has really let the people down. I do not want to forget the situation with the missing students. And they're really, we're learning more and more about the complicity between the Mexican government and their sort of suppliers of certain technology that has allowed the Mexican government to repress and suppress, I guess, its resistant population the same way in which the Israelis suppress Palestinians. I think that's the marketing tool. But what do we know? Could you just quickly remind people what happened to those students? Because the parents are still distraught, and we don't have the information we need on that incredibly important story.
And Dennis, I'm so grateful to you for bringing that up, because that's another event I want to share with you. We will be bringing one of the spokespersons for the collective of the parents and family members of the 43 missing students of Ayotzinapa in Guerrero. We will be bringing Doña Cristi to the Bay Area in collaboration with Global Exchange, with Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and with American Friends Service Committee. We're going to have an event October 24th from 4 to 6 p.m. at what used to be known as Hastings Law School. A lot of you know the story about why that name is in the process of changing. Let's call it ex-Hastings. That's October 24th from 4 to 6. And also in the mission on October 26th, we're in the process of confirming the date. It's important that it be on the 26th because the mass disappearance happened on September 26th, 2014. We're about to observe in a few days, just a few days, the 8th anniversary of that mass disappearance, which is still unresolved and the case is still unfolding. You might have seen headlines about first the arrest of Mexico's former attorney general for his complicity in this case. You also may have seen even more recently the arrest of at least one general in the Mexican army who was the local commander of the garrison in Guerrero during this incident in 2014, General Rodriguez Perez. And we're still awaiting, let's see if it ever happens, speaking of the current government in Mexico, the arrest orders against Mexico's then president, Peña Nieto, and the head of the Mexican military, the Secretary of the Defense there, named General Cienfuegos, who some of you might remember was being prosecuted by the DEA, and then he was rescued by the current Mexican government. And he's now back living in impunity in Mexico. And we also talked about that very high-level official, the former head of Mexico's FBI, who's hiding out in Israel because Israel, Tomas Zeron, because Israel does not have an extradition treaty with Mexico. So it's a very complex case, but you will hear it firsthand from one of the mothers of the missing 43, Doña Cristi, here in the Bay Area on October 24th and 26th. Please keep an eye out for information about those events. And We'll have also Kate Doyle from the National Security Archive. We'll have John Lindsay Poland from American Friends Service Committee. And we'll have Anayansi Diaz-Cortez, an extraordinary young journalist with Reveal, the Center for Investigative Reporting, who co-produced the path-breaking podcast on the case called After Ayotzinapa. So please join us October 24th and 26th, and we'll be able to bring this firsthand to you through your program, Dennis.
Amazing. Really important information. Camila Perez-Bustillo, again, his current, and we're happy to have him back in the Bay Area. He's executive director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the NLG, and he's a lot more than that, but that's a good place to work. Thanks, Camilo. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Dennis. I really appreciate it. We'll stay in touch.
All right. Stay safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're not going to leave this subject alone. A good friend of ours, Pierre Lebossier of the Haiti Action Committee, gets a lot of calls these days from the homeland, from Haiti, because the situation is created by the United States that destabilized that country repeatedly because it couldn't stand that there was a slave revolution that wanted self-determination and not the slavery of North America. Unbelievable story, the history of the Haitians fighting for self-determination, but it is brutal now on the ground in Haiti, and people are being arrested here at the border in the U.S. and being deported to the killing fields. Yeah, I'm going to call them killing fields of Haiti. We'll be right back with Pierre Lebossier. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine over the Pacifica Radio Network. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 out of the San Francisco Bay Area on the flagship of Pacifica. That's KPFA in the Bay. We're live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are honored to have you along with us, and honored also to welcome back to these airwaves our good friend Pierre Lebossier from the Haiti Action Committee. And Pierre has been one of our key sources on really staying abreast of what's happening on the ground in Haiti as a result of endless U.S. destabilization policies, which also included kidnapping on leap year the president, the duly elected president that the people of Haiti wanted, kidnapped President Aristide, and hell, it has been hell since really hell before, based on U.S. foreign destabilization policy. It is unforgivable, and it never comes up. It rarely, the real story rarely comes up in the mainstream media. It's actually been so terrible, the killing fields have been so deadly, that it's actually, Pierre Lebossier, been pushing its way here and there into the mainstream. You want to give us, take a few minutes and give us your version of what Haiti looks like on the ground, and tell us about some of the calls and some of the things you're hearing about.
Yes, thank you very much, Dennis. And I'm glad that you mentioned the kidnapping of President, former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Libya, 2004. And that was on 27th of February, 2004. And so that's, since then, it's been a continuing struggle by the Haitian people to regain their sovereignty and to stay alive. And also, it's been, and that's what's continuing to this day, because the people of Haiti have refused to let the forces that have managed, that carried out the coup d'etat, and have been trying to entrench this coup d'etat, and what it means for the population, people have been resisting it. What does it mean for the people of Haiti? Well, it means an end to the subsidy for gasoline, and which is very central to the uprising that's taking place today in Haiti. It's been also at the source of removing any subsidy for schooling, so that right now many parents can't afford to send their children to school. It has seen the destruction of Haiti's healthcare system, the education system, what had remained of our national production in the economy, the peasant economy, the local economy, completely destroyed, so that Haiti has become a country that's more and more dependent on importing basic food items that, when I was growing up in Haiti, we used to produce those things for ourselves, so that life now in Haiti has become so incredibly expensive. We are talking about a gallon of gas costing close to $8.50 to $9 a gallon. We are talking U.S. dollars, because the subsidies were removed from the subsidies that, when President Aristide was in office, he had put subsidies to keep the price of gasoline low. But the people who are bringing gasoline into Haiti are trying to, are speculating. And what they do is they create a scarcity of gas on the market, and then even though gas comes in, the gasoline will come in, but they'd rather they avoid the pumps so as to avoid any kind of price, whatever price control there is of the government, and then they can sell it. People line up with jugs to buy it by the gallon, or 5-gallon jugs. And that way they can manage to rip off the population and make massive profits. And there are tons of videos about it. People go and so as a result, when people are protesting against this, you have a police that's been trained by the United Nations occupation. And ever since, I have to say, ever since the coup d'etat against President Aristide, Haiti has been under a United Nations occupation of the country. So you have the Haitian police trained by the United Nations, particularly the U.S. and Canada, imposing, shooting people in the head, doing all kinds of brutalities against the population. So I don't want to go. You may have a question there. I don't want to keep going.
Oh, no. No. This is, we want to hear about this. And so let's keep talking about this. But let's now put it in the context of what happens to people when they get deported, because we know that the United States has been deporting Haitians by the hundreds, and they are not interested in whether they're going to survive even getting away from the airport. And we've seen now fierce battles trying to get Haitians off the planes because they're afraid. So talk more about life on the ground. And this is U.S. This is a result of U.S. destabilization policy.
Precisely, Dennis. And what we have is, there is what Haitians call insécurité. That means simply insecurity. What's going on in Haiti? You have so-called gangs, as they are referred to in the media. But I myself and several others, we call them death squads, because that's what they are. These are, they have the name gangs because then they appear to be not connected to the government. They appear to be outlaws. But this is a little game of semantics. Basically, they are enabled, financed, armed by, and they have complete impunity. So they are enabled finance by the Haitian government, and also they have gotten the blessing of the United Nations. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, his office, 2 years ago. Can you imagine so-called street gangs forming a federation and receiving from the Ministry of Social Affairs in Haiti under the government of Jovenel Moïse, they received a non-profit status, certificate of non-profit status, which was widely circulated among Haitians. And the office of the Secretary General said that wherever they were, that there was less murder being committed, as if they were forced for good. And this was so incredible for these guys to say that. And at the same time, these gangs were actually working in tandem with the police. They participated in the La Saline massacre, and just to call out a name, it's Barbecue, this guy named T. Junior, and so many others who were part of it. They conducted the massacre of La Saline, which is the poor neighborhood. They've been at the kidnapping people left and right, even going into church, doing church services, kidnapping pastors, kidnapping members of the congregation, burning people alive. These are the kinds of things that are going on. When those gangs don't get you, I can give you three examples of what happened to people recently. One of them, a young man, and this happened on Thursday, just last Thursday, Dennis, last Thursday, 21 years old. This young man, Thursday, the 18th of, when was that? That was the December, that was, I'm sorry, September 15th. And this young man was ranked number two in the baccalaureate exams that take place in Haiti. It's a combination of high school and the first year of college. And so he was ranked number two in the Port-au-Prince area, in the West Department. And here he was going to charge up his portable computer, his laptop, at a friend's house because there is no electricity. So the police targeted him, and they ended up shooting this young man. He hadn't died yet. They burned him alive. They put tires, burning tires on him. The police, the Haitian police, did that. And that was on the road to the airport, in that area of the airport. So that's one. 21 years old. He had received some scholarship and was supposed to go to Canada to study medicine. Just cut him down. Another young woman, named Doudouche, that's the only name that so far has come. And on Saturday, I think it was either Saturday evening or Friday, there was a barricade nearby, and she had gone on the streets to run her errands or what have you. And according to witnesses, the police started coming up the street and shooting at various people. She was hit by a bullet, but she hadn't died. There were four people who died as a result of that police shooting, indiscriminately. And she was screaming, "Help me." And many of the witnesses said they tried to help her, but the police told them that they would shoot them if they approached her. And the bulldozer that picks up trash or was removing the burning barricades lifted her body while she was still screaming, alive, dumped her in the garbage truck, and along with the burning materials, the tires and things in flame that they were dumping on her body. So that's the second instance. These are incredible crimes, atrocities taking place. In Lekai on Tuesday, last week, again, young man at home with his parents. The police came in to the house, grabbed him, took him outside, and shot him dead. So those are three among the many, many other atrocities that are being committed. And Dennis, to hear yes. the Secretary General of the UN declare either this morning or yesterday, I believe it was this morning, that Haiti needs, is all for a robust, that's his term, a robust force to come to Haiti to restore order. Haitians are, what it means, what does he mean by robust force? What it means really is a team of killers. That's what it means, a force of killers to come and do and add to the killings that are taking place inside Haiti. Let's not forget the track record of the UN in Haiti. Right after President Aristide was kidnapped from office, the UN, the advanced party of the UN, consisted of the U.S. troops, special troops, Canadian and French. And later on, they were joined, Brazil headed the multinational contingent that came in to reinforce this advanced group. And so they were notorious, and Dennis, you covered that with Kevin Pina and Nora yes. Barrows Friedman. You covered yes. the massacres that were taking place in Cité Soleil. I mean, people were demonstrating because their right to choose their representative was violated. They were standing up for democracy, and they were mercilessly mowed down. And the UN, right after the earthquake, the UN brought cholera into Haiti. The UN has never done anything good, and their soldiers left behind them a number of children who they didn't care whether they lived or died, children that they had fathered. And so this is the legacy of the UN, and much more, the destruction of our institution. They presided over that. They enforced what was going on there, the killings of the Haitian people, of the masses of the Haitian people. And that's the legacy that the UN has left us, so that today, Haiti has become a living hell for people in Haiti, and Haitians are fleeing, yet they are being brutalized when they flee to the Dominican Republic, when they come to the U.S. border, when they go to some other islands in the Caribbean. Dennis, what's going on there is really unspeakable. It's a horror. And to hear this man talk about Haiti needs a robust force. I'm saying all of this to tell people to raise a cry of alarm, to tell the audience, to please spread the word. Stand up with the Haitian people. Now, today, the Haitian people, they have never accepted it. They have taken to the streets and they said, liberty or death, that they'd rather die. And the more the police are killing them, the more they are fighting them with bottles and bricks and rocks, whatever they got. They are setting up barricades to protect their neighborhoods and they are demanding that lackey of these killers, of these international pirates, these international exploiters, these international racists, that Ariel Henry be gone from power. They are demanding
in order to put those guys in jail, they got to make a trip to Washington, because obviously